Have you ever met anybody who was in despair? What are they like?
Downcast.
I'm sorry?
Doom and gloom.
They have no hope.
They have no hope. This idea, do you think more people are despaired now than maybe in the past?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Our world.
Our world?
News media.
Facebook.
Facebook. How about, your phone. It isolates you. Here is a definition that I thought really worked well. It is the complete loss or absence of hope. I think that's a pretty good definition. That not just that you're down, it's the complete down. You're all the way down. I remember after having some surgery and I was confined to our apartment. We had just been married 4 months and I was all alone in an apartment. I couldn't drive, I couldn't get out. And I went down a tube. I went down. And I got to this place, I think. But it's not just for the average person, it's for despair also hits people who are very popular. If I'm going to show you a picture of a person, can you tell me who this is? Okay, anybody know his full name?
Henry
Winkler. Well, no, he has a middle name. Anybody know his middle name? No, it's Benjamin. But who is his character?
Bonds.
What was his real name?
Arthur.
Arthur Albert Fonzarelli. And there, he's got a, Henry Winkler's got a very interesting book out now talking about his life and how he tried to become an actor. And he went to audition and came back for a final audition for this role. And they had many other people, many more well-known characters, people you would know. He was a total unknown. But he went in there and this character just sort of came out of him. He is not like that at all. And you know, they signed him up and they said, well, you've got to ride a motorcycle. And when he tried to ride the motorcycle, he fell and almost hurt himself. So you'll notice if you ever watch Happy Days, you never see him riding. You see him sitting on it, but if there's a ride, that's a stunt double. Now, but you think about a guy, he's got it all, right? This famous, he's got money, fame, fortune, popularity. Listen to what he says about himself. He says, when I was on stage playing someone else, I was transported to another world, one where pretending made you successful. But he adds, what I was miserable at was being myself. That sounds like despair. It really does. He couldn't. About himself, he felt so alone, so unworthy, so low, that even though he had all of this, it wasn't enough. And we're going to look at a guy who, he had a government job, okay? That was his job. He worked for the government. Now, I don't know about you, if you've known any people who have worked for the government or not, or if you worked for the government or not, is that, come on in. Come on in. It's great. Good to see you. Is that you don't always get the biggest or the brightest. But this guy, his name is Nehemiah. And Nehemiah was a civil servant. He worked for the government. And so he was just another guy. He was working for the king. And anybody here ever move away from home? You move, what's that like?
Awful,
in a word, okay? Anybody really thought it was great? You thought it was great, and you're married. Okay, I get it.
No, not, it was way back.
Oh, way back, okay, the way, that, You're Mr. Peabody in the Wayback Machine. So his culture was he was from Israel over here, but Israel as a nation got taken into captivity, and he's over here in Susa. So, you know, he has lost any of his heritage. You know, they did strange things. Like this Thursday is what?
Thanksgiving.
So, of course, I'm going to make sauerkraut because that's what people from Baltimore do. Now, nobody else here ever thought about that, but that's what we do. And I remember going out to a Thanksgiving dinner in Tampa at a restaurant. And we sat there and we ordered the Thanksgiving spread, right? And they bring it all out and all the stuff. And I turned to our server and I said, "Where is the sauerkraut?" The look I got. No. But it was like that. It moved away completely different. And Israel had left. And when the Persian Empire had taken people away, guess what? They didn't go up to each house and, "Excuse me, we're taking over. Do you mind leaving?" Is that the way you think it happened?
No.
Think about what's going on in Gaza. Nobody's knocking on doors. They're kicking them in and dragging people away. Well, that's what happened to the nation of Israel. So Nehemiah's in Susa, and some people come back who went back to the land, and now they are reporting they're in Susa. And Nehemiah says, "Hey, people who talk like me, you know, like I'm from Baltimore. So what do we put when we open up the spigot? What comes out?
Water.
Wrong. Water.
Water.
Water. Right. You got to get some water. And it's George Washington, you know. So, you know, they speak my language. They understand. And what do they say? They survived the exile. And what do they say? There is what kind of trouble?
Great trouble?
Not just real trouble. Great trouble. What's the difference between trouble and great trouble?
Really bad.
It's bad. It's really bad. It's trouble on top of trouble. It's not your average trouble. It's not your average misery. It's really there. And they have disgrace. Ooh, have you ever felt disgraced? Don't talk about it because it's too disgraceful. It's really painful to talk about disgrace, isn't it? And they as a nation have been disgraced. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down. And the gates have burned with fire. We don't really get that. But what kept the enemies out back then?
Gates
and walls. And the walls are down. And the gates are burned. So guess what? That's like leaving your garage door open. I mean, not just unlocked. I mean, leaving it open, saying with a sign that says welcome and the lights on and people can just walk in. And when you receive bad news, what do you do? What's your normal thing when you receive bad news? What do you do?
Discouragement.
Anything else?
Upset.
You get upset? Anybody want to punch something? Get angry? You know, some people, that's the heritage I come from. You know, you get bad news, you hit somebody. I mean something. So he could have responded like that. This is bad. This isn't just news. This is really bad news. I mean bad news. But what does he do? He says, when I heard these things, what does he do? Does he punch something? Does he run a marathon?
No.
He sits down, and what did he do? Now, this is a guy, okay? This is a man. This is a man's man, and what does he do? He cries. He weeps. But he just doesn't do it. And then he prays, and weep and pray. Does he just do it? Oh, I'm all done. I'm better. No. He did it for what? For days. For days. Some days. And he mourned and fasted. Mornings, that's telling the world. That's putting on Facebook, I'm in mourning. You know, when my dad died, after I first had to make sure I called everybody that needed to be called. You got that list somewhere, right? At least in your head. Call, and then I put it out. And you know, that really just the process of telling people, and then the process of writing it, and then the process of receiving notices or condolences or calls. I mean, that really makes mourning real. It really does. And he says, then I said, after all this time, he's quiet. And then he says, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this, your big shot.
Servant.
It's not a CEO. No, it's not somebody who's got a bazillion dollars, got a yacht or two. He's a servant who delights in revering your name. Give success when? Today. He knew something. He was going to be able to see the king today, and he didn't know what he was going to do or what he was going to say. And grant him favor. And it says that he was the cupbearer of the king. Now, we don't have cupbearers anymore. We really don't understand who they are, what they do. But I think the closest thing I could come up with was this scene from The West Wing. When Charlie, remember if you saw West Wing Charlie to become the president's aide? This is his interview.
So have a seat. I'm sure you understand why we have to go through this. It's a very sensitive job. It's also a very hard job. 20-hour days aren't uncommon. Long trips at the last minute, a lot of wait and hurry up. Moreover, there'll be times when you have to make yourself invisible in plain sight, as well as an undeniable force in front of those who want more time than we want to give. Sometimes the people I'm talking about will be kings and prime ministers. You understand so far?
Sir, I'm sorry, but I think there's been some kind of mistake.
Really?
See, I came here. I filled out an application for...
Yeah, I have your paperwork.
Right. See, I came here. I was looking for a job as a messenger.
Yes.
And I had an interview with Miss DeLaGuardia, and she told me to wait.
Yes.
And then she told me to come here.
Yes, that's because we asked Miss DeLaGuardia to keep an eye out. She's recommending you for a different job.
Sir, if you don't mind me asking...
Personal aide to the president. You don't have to call me sir.
I don't understand.
Personal aide to the president. Traditionally a young guy, 20, 25 years old, excels academically, strong in personal responsibility and discretion, presentable appearance.
But sir...
We obviously get quite a few candidates who meet those qualifications, so the rest is just gut instinct. Or you could bribe me.
You know... We don't have butlers, we don't have cupbearers, but a personal assistant. That's sort of what it's like. You got direct access to the person who's in charge. You may not have power, but you've got your hand in the hand of the one who does. And that was his role. And so here that next day, this day, he's going to be before the king, and he has all of this weight of, excuse me, all of this weight of the mourning and everything else and everything that's lost. And he says, so it's April, and the king's been in power for 20 years. No elections, thank you. So he goes to take wine before the king, and what does the king say? He says, hey, Knee, I wonder if he called him Knee, short for Nehemiah. I don't know. But hey, you've never been sad before in my presence. And, you know, what's going on? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. And what's his response to the king? Oh, the king says you're sad. That's not a big deal, is it? In this day and time, it is. Because that was... he was looking for signs that maybe somebody was going to kill him. And, you know, having their face not being joyful. And now he says, I was very much afraid. His life hangs by a thread. The next words that come out of his mouth can mean all the difference in the world. But he goes on and he says that,
holy smokes. Whoo! Danger, danger, danger. Unbelievable.
Remember this guy?
He's gone now.
He's gone. Yeah, he had some danger. Yeah, Steve Irwin. That's exactly how Nehemiah felt. Danger, 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 danger. I don't know how you say that with a Jewish accent, but he's, you know, he knows he's in trouble. He knows that, you know, what's right in front of him could be mean all the difference between life and death. And so he says to the king, live forever. You know, I'm not here, but there is trouble. What is the trouble? My city lies in ruins. Remember the pictures from 9/11? Afterwards, both, you know, the World Trade or the Pentagon. Those images really stuck with us. And they said something, didn't they? They said, you know, we're not invincible. And Nehemiah is saying, you know, where I came from, the cities where I grew up in have been destroyed. The gates are destroyed. The city's in ruins. You know, yeah, of course I'm sad. But it's not because of you. It's because of my people. He says, my people. And so the king says to him, you know, has this relationship. And this is the question you always want to get. The king says what? What do you want? What do you want to do? What do you want from me? And what is Nehemiah's response?
He prayed.
He didn't pull out his phone and said, Kingy, I'm glad you brought that up. I've got this plan right here, and if you'll just sign, you know, that'll take care of everything. Now, he had planned for sure in his head, but he says he prayed to the Lord. He said, before I open my mouth, before I engage my tongue, before I insert my foot in my mouth, I'm going to ask God. So he says, he prayed, and he says, if I have found favor in your sight. Remember what George was talking about this morning about how to share your faith? Yes. Remember, was it so much on technique, on say just the right words?
No.
It was what?
From the heart.
From the heart and from our lives. You see, his life, Nehemiah's life, had been speaking to the king all these years, all this time. And he had built up credibility. You don't just drop a dime and say, oh, I got credibility. Credibility takes what?
Time.
Takes time, takes effort. It means you've got to do it. And you got to do, is it one big thing? No, it's over and over and over again. He had that. And so he says, if I found favor in your sight, send me so I can rebuild. He didn't say, send those other guys, because it's going to be an uncomfortable, it's going to be a long journey, you know, and they don't have a lot of Howard Johnsons along the way, you know. No, he says, send me so that I can rebuild it. So he prays, and we talk about prayer a lot, but I want to talk to you about the three ships of prayer, because I really believe this is helpful in sort of figuring out whether, first of all, how we're praying, or, you know, is God listening? And are we set for, I don't want to say do it right, but God's looking for certain things when we pray. He really is. The first of these ships is friendship. And this is very popular today. God is my buddy, right? He's my guy, you know, and we're good buddies. We're good friends. And that's good to a point. You know, God's invitation is for us to do what? Come. That's his friendship. His extending, say, y'all come. You come. And that's God's friendship. But it doesn't end there. And now this next one is really when the crickets start rubbing their back legs together, and that's lordship. Yeah, it's nice to talk to God on friendly terms, but then say, God, you know, you are really the boss. You are my loving Lord. And that means anything you ask of me is coming from your heart of love and kindness. It doesn't feel like it. You ever have one of those things where God gives you something and you say, boy, that really didn't feel good? You got one of those in your mind? But God says, it's for your good. It's for my purpose. It's for my glory. So that's, we got friendship, we got lordship, which leads to sonship, that we are members of his family. Now, for those of you here who are not of the son gender, I put this up, but I did it for a reason. The reason is, back in the day, okay, women never inherited anything. They didn't. When the fathers died, that was it. Everything went to the son. But in Jesus Christ, there's neither male nor female. And so all of us, I don't care. We all enjoy that child relationship with God through Christ, and we receive the benefits of him being our father. And we have access to this because of Jesus' death on the cross. You see, Nehemiah was a godly guy, but he really did face despair. And so did many early Christians. I don't know if some of you, we think, oh yeah, you know, they came to Jesus. You know, there was the day of Pentecost. There's a sermon. Thousands of people come. And it was just one big party. It wasn't. Listen to Paul. He says, I don't want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the what?
Troubles.
Troubles. The troubles we experienced in Asia. We were under not just pressure.
Great pressure.
Great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure. So that we despaired of life. That's how bad it was. Now that's bad. Despaired of life, that's bad. But it goes on. But this happened, why? So we didn't rely on ourselves. Have you ever been at that point where you relied on yourself? I have. God, I got the answer. And let me tell you what the plan is so you can come on board. I hate that expression. So God, I got the plan. I know the people to talk to, all the steps that got to happen. But it's so we don't rely on ourselves. But we want to rely on him. When we've set our hope. And that's not just, scratching some dirt with our toe. That's laying a foundation. I don't know if anybody here has ever poured concrete. Anybody here ever pour concrete? Isn't that a great job?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, I love it. You know, I know now, the people who work with concrete today, I feel bad for them because they didn't know the privilege, the sheer joy of carrying concrete in those wheelbarrows, of running the wheelbarrow up the wooden ramp that was only one board wide And you know what? Somehow it got wet. And it got slippery. And the one thing you didn't want to do was dump your load on the side, right? You wanted to take it up. You know, but now it just gets pushed through tubes. Oh, those poor people, they don't know what they're missing. But, you know, to set like concrete, you know, that we can set our hearts on God. You know, and that's where Paul says in Ephesians, finally, what are we to be?
Strong
in ourselves. Strong in the Lord. And his mighty power. It's his domain. It's his place. It's his power. We rest on him. We rest in him. We sink our feet in the concrete of who Jesus is and say, I'm not going to be moved. There was a guy who went through some trouble in his life. I'm going to read a quote from his book, and then I'll tell you who he is. But sometimes we get to the point of thinking, I've got to be perfect. Anybody ever thought that? I was talking to somebody the other day. Oh, I got to be perfect. It's like, you know what? That's why we got Jesus. Listen to what Rick Warren says about being perfect. The Christian life isn't a mistake-free life, but it can be guilt-free life. God understands your failures, and he loves you anyway. With all the failures, with all the mistakes, with all the mishits, he still loves me. Now, that just blows my mind, because I don't know about you. I have missed hitting the nail on the head so many times, it's not even funny. And yet, knowing all that, Jesus stayed on the cross. Another guy said it this way, absolute commitment doesn't mean absolute obedience. Yeah, we can be committed, but there's no guilt, because that's why Christ died, and we can take our lives to him. Listen to this quote. You know, look at God's incredible waste of his saints according to the world's judgment. God seems to plant his saints in the most useless places. And then we say, God intends for me to be here because I am so useful to him. God, you're really lucky to have me on your team. You know, I'm here and I got you covered. But he goes on to say, yet Jesus never measured anything in his life about how or where he was of the greatest use. Do you ever think about that? Jesus, when he lived his life, didn't say, oh, this is the best use of me. No. God placed his saints where they will bring the most glory to him. And we are totally incapable of judging where that may be. You know, think, God, you can use me better over here. Or God, I'm much better suited over there with those people. And God just sits there and says, you're where you're at because I love you and I need you there. And I want you right there. And the guy was, anybody hear of Oswald Chambers? You ever hear of him? You ever hear of him? And his fabulous book, My Utmost for His Highest, right? What a great guy. He was born in Scotland, where he grew up. He had a ministry of teaching and preaching. He went to the United States and Japan. He was all over the United Kingdom. And the last 6 years of his life, he was the Bible teaching at a college in London and then a YMCA chaplain with the troops in outside of Cairo in Egypt. And he's best known for this book, My Utmost for My Highest. There's only one problem. He didn't write it. He didn't write it. You see, he died in 1917 at the age of 42, and all of his books were published after that. But his wife, Gertrude Hobbs Chamber, they were only married for 7 years. She's the one who published all of those books. He's got like 30 books under his name. Didn't write a single one of them. You see, Gertrude grew up and she had bronchitis and she couldn't go to school as well, but she wanted to be used, and she got it in her head that her calling was that she was going to be a secretary to the Prime Minister of England. Sounds like a pretty good job. And what did secretaries do back then? They did shorthand, right, and typing. So she went to, let me get it here, she went to the Pitman Correspondence School, where she learned shorthand. And she then said, anybody can do shorthand. I want to be the best at shorthand possible. So you know what she did? She had her mother and her sister read books and magazines to her while she would then take shorthand, and then they would check it. She could do 250 words a minute, which is flying. Never had any thought about what was going to be. She marries Oswald, and Oswald's up there, and he's teaching the Bible. And where's Gertrude?
Taking shorthand.
In the back, taking shorthand. That's all she did. She, after, and so he died. And she has, this is before, long before Social Security, life insurance. So as a widow, and she had a daughter, she immediately fell into poverty, crushing poverty. But she took all those transcriptions, and she started putting them together. And also his notes from his own Bible that he had written in. And she started producing his books. And 7 years after his death, My Utmost for His Highest is published. 13 million copies, 39 languages. From 1924 to this day, it has never been out of print. There's that much demand. It is. I don't know if you've ever read this. If you haven't, First, read my book, of course. But you really, really, really ought to get this one. It is a great book by a man who loved God and was broken. Now, you know what? I wonder about Gertrude. I want to talk to her. I would say, hey, Gertie. I wonder if they call her. Actually, Oswald called her Betsy or Bert, Betty or something. But I want to say, Gertie. What happened? You had plans, you know, to be the secretary for the prime minister. And then you marry a preacher? What's up with that? What kind of career path change is that? And then he dies after 7 years of marriage, and now you're a penniless widow. And you start, and you pull those transcripts out, and you start publishing your husband's books. Don't you want to be a co-author? Don't you? Her name doesn't appear on any of the books as written by humility. That she was willing to let God take her down a different path than the one she had planned out. Did you ever think that you would be here in Winter Haven 10 years ago?
No.
20 years ago? How about 50 years ago? Not quite 50 years ago, this month, Marion and I were married on the 29th. And we went, of course, because I was making the plans, we went to Disney World, because that's where Chet wanted to go. And Marianne wanted to go to the beach. So we spent a couple of days in the Magic Kingdom, and we rented a car, and I thought, well, we're going to go over to Tampa. Now, what connects Orlando to Tampa?
I-4.
Are we going to drive? Back then, it was only four lanes. Not as much traffic. But I thought, you know, we're in the neighborhood. Why don't we go to Cypress Gardens, which I had visited as a kid on our first vacation. And I thought this might be interesting for this woman I'm trying to impress. Failing miserably. So we came to Cypress Gardens. You know, we came down Route 4, I-4 to 27. Okay, at this point, I-4 is four lanes. We hit Route 27 and head south. And what's between I-4 on 27 to Winter Haven back in that day?
Nothing.
Orange Groves. But there was the Kansas City Royals at that point had their spring training. Right off there was a place called Boardwalk and Baseball. Gone. So anyway, all the Orange Groves, gone. We hit Cypress Garden Boulevard, we turn right. It's a two-lane highway that like is going like this, okay? You know, there is nothing. There's no State Farm building, there's no Walmart, there's no McDonald's. You know, it's just old Florida. And we come to Winter Haven. What's Winter Haven known for? Well, back then it had the Boston Red Sox and the Cleveland Indians. Excuse me, they're not the Indians anymore. They're the Cleveland, what are they?
Guardians.
I'll never get used to this. So anyway, you know, so we go there, and guess what? That's only three and a half miles from here. Never did I ever think that we'd be in the same neighborhood. Six moves, 15 jobs, and here we are. Few years down the road. Never would have imagined it. But through all that time, God was leading. There's an old hymn most of you won't remember. He leadeth me, O blessed thought, O words of heavenly comfort fraught. Where'er I go, where'er I be, still God's hand that leadeth me. Sometimes mid scenes of deepest gloom, sometimes where Eden's flowers bloom, by waters calm or troubled sea, still 'tis God's hand that leadeth me. And when my task on earth is done, when by thy grace the victory won, in death's cold wave I will not flee, since God through Jordan leadeth me. He leadeth me, he leadeth me, by his own hand he leadeth me. His faithful follower I will be, for by his hand he leadeth me. We see that in Proverbs. He says, in their hearts, in the hearts of people, we plan their course, but the Lord establishes the steps. Now, I don't know about you, I read this verse wrong, backwards, most of my life. I say, God, here's my plan, bless my plan. Have you ever said that to God? Bless my plan. This doesn't say bless my plan. It says bless my step. My next step, God, be with that. And then be with the next step after that. God is the God of the detail. Yeah, he knows the end from the beginning, but our faithful walk is step by step. We're the kind of people that says this step, only then after we do the steps that maybe we'll get the vision for his plan. But God says it's all about the next step. And so it is for you and for me this week, the next step of faith, the next step in front of us. God is more interested in your next step and my next step. He really is. And our job is to allow him to walk with us. He doesn't force his way. He stands at the door and knocks, right? He doesn't kick it down. He says, I want you to invite me on the way. Would you pray with me? Our Father and our God, I'm so grateful that you have brought us here. The path for some of us have been pretty straightforward and easy, and for some of us, the path has been really windy and hard. But you still lead, and you want that next step. Oh God, may we give you the next step, and then the one after that. In Jesus' name, amen.